So, good evening, everyone. So I'm going to continue today with the series I'm giving on the seven factors of awakening. So I think 2 weeks ago or so I gave a kind of broad overview on the overview of the seven factors of awakening. And then last week I gave a talk on the first factor, which is mindfulness. And today's topic, usually in English Dharma circles, it's called investigation. And can everybody hear okay? Okay. So the seven factors of awakening are considered to be beautiful qualities of mind or heart that get awakened or get developed in the process of becoming awake. Becoming liberated. And they create the kind of ideal conditions in the mind to let the mind take that leap of completely letting go of the deepest things that we're attached to. And it's quite significant, I think, that this very challenging thing to do, which is to let go of what we most cling to, that ability to do that is most supported by having the presence of these beautiful qualities of mind. So mindfulness is one. Second topic of tonight is investigation. The third is energy, effort. The fourth is joy. The fifth is tranquility. The sixth is concentration. And the seventh is equanimity. And these are considered kind of like the jewels of Buddhist practice. It's not necessarily easy to have them become strong and stabilized in our minds. In particular, they become strong and stabilized in the minds of people who are meditators, especially on meditation retreats. We have a long time to do it. But they also can be something that becomes present in people's lives as well. And part of the reason to talk about them is that the recognizing of these qualities when they're present strengthens them. If we don't recognize them when they're there, they don't get strengthened, they don't get nourished. Now the word awakening, I'm very fond of, and I like the idea of sometimes of talking about mindfulness is about the practice of being awake to what is happening. And what I like about the word awake is that it really stresses a subjective presence, a subjective quality of alertness, of clarity that we can have in the circumstances we find ourselves in. So we can say we are awake to, I was asleep, but then I was awake. And that can happen, you know, just waking up from night sleep. But also people can go around in the days living in some kind of delusion, living some kind of fantasy, living in some kind of projection. And then with a puff, the projection, the fantasy can vanish. And we kind of wake up and we see, oh, it's a different place. And to give you one example, in my life, a moment where I kind of, many moments are kind of waking up, but one example, little example of when I was a Zen student at Green Gulch Farm, they have a very big meditation hall. And they have a big altar, big statue of a Buddha. And the way this the altar is situated, it's not up against the wall, but it's a little bit away from the wall. And so you could actually walk behind it, to the back of it. And then there was this line that went from the midpoint of the Buddha straight away from the Buddha to the opposite wall. And from the Buddha to the opposite wall, opposite to the Buddha, you weren't supposed to cross that line. Because somehow that was disrespectful to the Buddha. You don't walk in front of a Buddha. It was the kind of the etiquette of the place. So if you wanted to get to the other side of the meditation hall, you had to walk around the back of the altar to get there. So sometimes it's kind of silly because, you only needed to go like 2 feet or 1 foot. But there was a big hall, so you had to walk it, 50 feet around, all the way around, because you couldn't cross that line. And so in my mind, that line became electric. you know, became like his force field. Like, you don't cross that line. And I would, you know, I get close to that line and I kind of feel, oh, you know, I should kind of cross that line. And it, you know, it was a real thing. It was really strongly present for me. And then one day I was on one end in the corner of the meditation hall just doing something, cleaning or something, and some Dharma tourists came in. They just were kind of visitors who were just checking things out, and they were kind of walking around the meditation hall. It was off hours. And they didn't know anything. They didn't know anything about the etiquette of the place, and they certainly knew nothing about this line. And so they crossed right in front of the altar. And there was no lightning, and they didn't get electrocuted. Nothing happened to them. And that was that moment I kind of woke up. And I realized, oh, there's no force field there. It's all a function of the imagination, the collective imagination of all these people who are projecting this line, this significance to this line. There's nothing there beyond what we're kind of making it up as we go along. So I felt I woke up to that projected quality of that line. And it felt kind of awake. Oh, and I kind of felt like I saw the room in a new way, in a clearer way. One of the reasons I like the word awake is awake doesn't imply that anything in the world has changed. Our projections might have changed. Our delusions about it might have changed. But, you know, it's not like we're trying, not that necessarily anything has gone away or made it happen. It's just kind of, it's this kind of very lucid quality of kind of, oh, this is what it is. Kind of clarity. And it's a nice word for mindfulness because sometimes mindfulness has such baggage with it that some people, after many years of doing mindfulness practice, all these associations of what it means to be mindful. You have to kind of try hard. You're supposed to note what's there. You're supposed to label it. You're supposed to do this and that with it and, you know, penetrate it, you know. And mindfulness is like this complicated thing for some people after learning all these things that I'm trying to teach you. And just to be awake is much more simple. It's more clean. So the seven factors of awakening. Now, another reason I like the word awake is that to be awake in some clear way, crisp way, you can kind of feel that it comes with other qualities as well. It comes with a kind of alertness. It comes with a certain kind of energy, kind of a little energized. It comes sometimes with an ability to be a little bit more balanced in the situation, more spacious. When you're really awake and clear, something unfortunate can happen, and you're more balanced, you're more able to take and receive it without getting reactive and caught by it and your buttons pushed. And so these different qualities that come with the seven factors of awakening, I think you can kind of maybe intuit or feel that they're there in some conventional sense of really being awake. You know, if you take a really good nap and wake up in the middle of the afternoon and, wow, I feel really clear. You kind of look around inside your mind. Maybe you feel some intimation of these seven factors right there. So one of the factors is called investigation. In English, it's often translated as investigation. And the Pali word is Dhamma Vichaya. And I will first give you what I learned to be the kind of basic, when I was kind of learning this practice in the Buddhist tradition I learned it in, and when I learned it from Western teachers, I'll give the kind of basic way I was taught first. And then I'll give you the more ancient way that it's taught. If you go back to the ancient Buddhist sutras, teachings of the Buddha. And both are instructive, both are helpful, and both have their place. So the way that I was taught, this Dhamma Vichaya means to investigate, the factor of investigation. And investigation can be summarized by having the kind of the approach or the question in your mind, what is this? So not what is that happened yesterday, what is, you know, something abstract. But in the moment, if you're present for something, there's a simple question, what is this? And that question kind of like helps you kind of, let's look more closely. Let's not assume we know what it is. Let's find out anew. Even though I've seen this maybe 10 times, I went into that meditation hall hundreds of times, and I never saw that meditation hall in a new way until the Dharma tourists helped me. And in theory, I didn't need the Dharma tourists. I could have somehow woken up on my own if I somehow understood the nature of that line. So to ask the question, or you don't have to ask the question, but that kind of approach, what is this? Let me look more closely. And this is particularly important in Vipassana, because what we understand in Vipassana practice, in mindfulness practice, is a big part of the way we experience life is a projection. We all have a lot of assumptions, beliefs, interpretations of events, of ourselves, of other people. And some of those, many of those interpretations and projections are not really accurate, or they might be partially accurate. And so to have the ability to see through the projections, the interpretations, the ideas, allows you to kind of connect more fully, to see more clearly what is actually happening. And one of the things to see that's really helpful in seeing more clearly is to see when a projection is, or an assumption is arising in the mind. To have the ability to see, oh, I'm seeing so-and-so, and now I have this thought that so-and-so is that kind of person. And you can see the mind producing that thought, and you say, oh, that's a thought in my mind. It might not be true. That's a mind thought. Who knows if it's true out there? But you see it as a product of the mind. And as you see it as a product of the mind, then there's a possibility of analyzing it or questioning it. That's a thought. Let me look around that thought and see if I can see the person directly. Let me hold that thought, that interpretation, lightly and look for further evidence. If you don't have that capacity to look carefully at the arising of an idea, an assumption, a belief, then it's all too easy to assume that to have this kind of deep underlying, or this deep kind of assumption, unconscious assumption, that my interpretation, my assumptions, are really what's out there. And so we have all this projection onto people, all kinds of projection. And so part of the ability to see what's really happening is also being able to see how the mind creates its assumptions, interpretations, its beliefs, its ideas. And then beyond that, it's to look behind or beyond the interpretations, assumptions, the beliefs, the concepts, and start seeing more deeply what is actually here. And in Buddhism, it's a deep insight in Buddhism, that if we're able to look deeply beyond the layer of concepts that we paint reality with, one of the things we'll see is how much our experience, our world, what's going on, is arising and passing. It's inconstant. It's constantly in motion of arising and appearing. It's impermanent, deeply impermanent. And this is considered to be one of the really important insights in Buddhism, to see the impermanent nature of our experience of life. It's very fascinating to understand the impermanent nature of ourselves and our self-concepts. We change quite a bit. In many ways, we don't see our change. Sometimes if we kind of lock into certain assumptions and belief about ourselves. But human beings are also quite fluid. And so what comes to mind as an example here is doesn't speak very well about me in this example, but example of myself. I was once I left home when I was 18, that basically was a poor hippie for a long time, hitchhiking around and stuff, and going to college hippie. And then I became a Buddhist practitioner and became a monk and had very little money. And there was a period of time where my stipend as a monk was $60 a month. But then I was doing really well, because there was an even bigger period where I didn't get any stipend at all. So, I didn't have much money. And then, when I came to, in 1990, I came to Stanford to study at Stanford, a doctoral program. And my mother gave me her old car. I was very happy with her old car, just puttered around. It was red, so it was kind of cool. And I was driving around, you know, in Palo Alto area for a while, for a number of years, in that old red beat-up car. And I noticed after a while that in Palo Alto, back then, I haven't been there for a while, so maybe it's changed, but back then, there weren't a lot of old beat-up cars. And, what?
Hasn't changed?
And actually, just before I lived in this area, I lived in San Francisco, and I had my car there. And having my car there, there, you know, was one of many old cars, you know, and it never occurred to me I should have it should be any different way. But once I was hanging out in Palo Alto, you know, it'd be good to have a new car. A new car would be a good thing. A new car. New car. New car thoughts. And so what it was an example of, I think, was the way in which I was influenced by my environment. And my desires, what I wanted, and what I thought would look cool or, I don't know, good or something. You know, it's kind of embarrassing to think. Was influenced by the environment that I was in. So that's an example of the kind of impermanence. And I can give you, that's just maybe a silly example, but I can give you lots of examples of how fluid I am, in a sense, and adaptable we are. But the normal assumptions and beliefs of who we are often tend to be kind of locked in. I'm no good. Or something, you know. I'm not good enough or something. All kinds of ideas people can have. So one of the very interesting things that begins happening if you look deeply, investigate deeply, and you see the arising and passing of identities. And they change over time. And sometimes the identities that we have are a little bit antiquated. Sometimes we're holding on to an old identity. And actually, we've changed. And I see that in myself. I have various identities And sometimes I'm surprised to find out that I'm 53. Because there's a part of me that still thinks I'm 21. Not like, you know, I'm just 21, kind of bumbling and, you know, bumbling, kind of not quite sure what life's about. It was a little bit strange to go to, and I was in the early 20s, I was a new student at Zen Center, at San Francisco Zen Center. And there were all these, you know, great Zen teachers there. And I was just a little kid, you know, looking up at these great Zen teachers. And then now I go to meetings where they treat me as a peer, the same ones who were my great teachers. And it's kind of strange, you know, because I'm still like a little kid, you know, and they're looking at me as a teacher now, kind of an equal, and I'm still like, I haven't caught up to myself in that identity. So sometimes we have these old, you know, old ideas, old identities, we're still kind of haven't learned to shift and change. And sometimes we're ahead of ourselves, of course, you know, all kinds of ways this happens. So the investigation quality is to look more deeply. And one of the deep qualities we can see behind the way we're stuck on concepts, you start seeing how things are impermanent. And one of the really fascinating areas of impermanence is to notice our own impermanence. How we change over time in all kinds of different ways. And then one of the tasks of practice, I believe, is to learn to become more at peace or comfortable with all the changes. And if you're not going to be comfortable or at peace, or if you're not going to learn to be, to not, if you're going to learn, if you're not going to learn to let go of conflict with change, then you really do well not to age. But, you know, if you want to learn how to be peaceful in your life and not in conflict with yourself, then you can learn to be gracious with the whole aging process. So the investigation, looking deeply, what is this? What is our experience? So it can be as simple as, you know, if you have physical pain, and I think a lot of people who've been meditators for a while have hopefully learned how to do this. might be some pain, is to be able to identify the way in which we relate to that pain, to see the concepts, the ideas we have that we overlay the pain, and then be able to look behind the concept and experience the pain as a direct experience, below the concept, below the idea of pain, and to start feeling the pain in the detail, the details of sensation that make up that experience, and to see the arising and passing of pulsing and tightening and searing and twisting and pulling and all the things that can make up the pain experience. And it's actually it can be very fascinating to get in there really, really close to investigative mind and really see and feel the tremendous detail of experience of sensations that go on in a experience of pain. And normally people hold themselves at a distance from pain and don't enter into it in a deep way. And sometimes the experience of pain transforms itself, changes itself, and it's no longer pain if you get really down deep into it. So that's interesting. So that was how I was introduced to the whole teachings on the factor of awakening called investigation. As I said earlier, in the Pali language, in the ancient language of Buddhism, the term that's translated as investigation is called Dhamma Vichaya. And Vichaya means could mean investigate. It can also mean analysis, analysis, investigate, be discerning. And Dhamma the word Dhamma is the Pali word for Dharma. Dharma has a range of meanings. And one meaning means qualities, like the qualities of the mind. So investigation or analysis of your own qualities. So it isn't simply just looking at the pain or looking at, you hear a sound outside and you listen to the sound. You don't simply look at, physical sensations, but you look at the quality of the mind, the qualities present in the mind as you experience something. So, for example, perhaps someone walks in here late during one of the meditation sessions, and they have lumberjack boots on. They have, a Velcro coat. And they snort. Whatever, and but anyway, so they come in and they slam that door open and they slam the door closed, and so one direction the mind can go is, who's that jerk? How could they let someone like that into a quiet meditation center? Don't the person know where he is? This shouldn't be. This is really a travesty. And I'm going to have to write a letter to the president of the board of IMC. I'll go to that board meeting tomorrow night and give them a peace of mind about these people. Can you believe those people? So that's one approach. The other approach is you hear the bang. You feel yourself kind of energized. You feel your thoughts of anger and thinking about this person, a jerk, arise. And then you say, oh, this is interesting. Let me look at this. Let me look at the qualities of my mind. What's going on in my mind? So rather than staying, lingering with judgment and ideas out there, turn around and look at yourself. See, what's happening here for myself? In other words, it's one way of saying taking responsibility for how you're feeling and what your mind is doing on that event out there. So once you realize it's, you're safe, the person's not going to attack you, then you go, okay, let's look here. Let's start taking responsibility here for what's happening for myself. So this is to turn a look at the qualities of your own experience and your own mind. So you might feel yourself tight. You might feel yourself a little bit afraid. You might feel yourself judgmental. You might find that the mind has gotten small. You were very soft and relaxed. And then with this experience, you feel kind of jolted. But as you start thinking about this, how terrible this person is, it contracts your belly. And you get all tight. So you feel a tightness. You feel how you're holding on to ideas. You feel, maybe you notice how you have certain assumptions about how precious and important your meditation time is. And now someone has ruined it. You feel that clinging to mind meditation. This was supposed to be my salvation from a busy day. And so you're really attached. So you say, oh, this attachment. So you look at that. Oh, look at that. I'm attached. I have these beliefs, these ideas. They run around. So you look at all that. So to look at yourself. To really understand what's happening here. Now, this is a very important phenomenon, thing to do. Very helpful. And a way to get to how it's a helpful simile, analogy, is that if you go into an ecosystem, a stable ecosystem, and you introduce a new species, like a new weed or something, the whole ecosystem might shift and change with this one simple change. So we have this ecosystem of the mind, and some ecosystems are stabilized in ecosystems of neurosis or something. Not so interesting, some not so healthy. And you introduce a new species into the ecosystem, the whole thing changes. And so the new species, in a sense, can be investigation. If you introduce investigation into the ecosystem of your mind, the whole mind has to shift and change. And so there's a variety of things, and investigation is not a weed. Investigation is a good thing. So it's maybe reintroducing an almost extinct animal back into its ecosystem. So, for example, so if you bring investigation into your experience, in that moment of investigation, you're not identifying so strongly with your thoughts and beliefs. And so you step back a little bit. And that stepping back and getting kind of like a little bit of a bird's eye view, a little bit more dispassionate view of what's happening, is very radical, a shift in the mind. You're not so caught anymore. You bring a quality of investigation to your experience. It can also come sometimes with a feeling of strength. Well, that's a strong thing to do. You feel a little strength, a little stability in a situation where you felt maybe unstable. Okay, I'm going to investigate. What's going on here? It can create some space. It can create some a little more ease. It can create a little bit of distance, healthy distance. It can create strength, inner sense of strength or stability. And then if on top of that, the investigation actually shows you something, then you start understanding what's going on. And the understanding itself, being able to understand what's there, if you understand what's there, then you're not going to be pulled around by your thoughts, your beliefs, and your feelings. But rather you see how they operate, and then there's more choice in how you choose to act and respond. So this area of choice is very important, because one of the meanings of dharma, so remember it's analysis or investigation of dharma, one of the classic meanings is it's a form of wisdom, or it's a utilizing your intelligence to analyze, understand, to be able to make differentiations in your experience, to discover where the choices are that you can make, that you make, that influence your suffering, or that help cause more suffering, or cause more happiness or freedom. So as we, so what it means is that we, so dharma also has the meaning of teaching. In the Buddhist context, it's the teachings of the Buddha. So it's analyzing your experience through the perspective of Buddhist teachings. So now it doesn't mean, you know, getting a PhD in Buddhism and then overlaying on your experience a whole Buddhist framework of, you know, some Buddhist abstraction in your experience. What it means is taking a very simple, from the simplest concepts of Buddhism, and using that as a frame of reference to understand better what's happening here and now in a way that's helpful for you. And the frame of reference is the Four Noble Truths. That's the Dharma and the essence. So you analyze the situation you're in. You look at it, you investigate here and now. Oh, how do the Four Noble Truths, how are they playing themselves out here and now in this situation? So, you know, back to that Green Gulch Zen meditation hall with that line in front of them there. You know, I was the custodian of the meditation hall for a while, and back then I wasn't so mindful in this kind of way. And I remember people would kind of, some people who didn't know were kind of get close to that line, and I would tell them, don't go there, which was my job partly. But also I remember that sometimes I got kind of tense. if I was practicing mindfulness using the Four Noble Truths, I would have noticed my tension. And I would have seen that I had a choice whether to stay tense or to let go of the tension. If the person comes in here really loud, I can see the place of choice where I pick up, I get attached to, cling to, some resentment. Or get cling to, hold on to in some painful way, some idea that someone else is responsible, has to fix this problem. Or if I'm sitting here with physical pain when I'm meditating, I can feel the quality of self-pity that might arise. And actually see that and see the place of choice where I'm picking up those thoughts and going away with them. Or I see the place of choice where I can let go of it, where I can let go of that clinging. I see how that, what I'm clinging to brings me that suffering. So part of the function of investigation is to help us understand in practical, immediate, real way, in our experience, how we're doing this, how the Four Noble Truths are happening for us. We need to see where the suffering is, the tension, the discomfort, see where psychological discomfort is, to see the cause of it in the kind of clinging, the kind of grasping that's going on in our mind, and then to see the possibility of letting go of that. That's a, you know, it's easy to say, sometimes it's very difficult to do, but it's a very simple analysis. And part of the value of this analysis is that it helps us take responsibility for our experience, what's going on. And it helps us to find the place of change in life where we have the most ability to change things. We can't always change things in the world, but we can look at, and if we want to be happy, we can look at ourselves and see how we contribute. And so the investigation of the Dharma, or using these Dharma principles to analyze our experience, slowly, bit by bit over time, you start to be in some very small steps, becomes a stronger and stronger capacity that allows you to notice very quickly the ways in which you get caught, the ways you get cling, the ways in which you resist in unnecessary ways. And starts slowly, slowly gives you a greater capacity to relax, to release, to let go. And this is really at the heart of Buddhist spirituality. It's this ability to see where we're responsible, our contribution to our suffering. It's not to deny that other people sometimes are conditions for our suffering, and that something has to happen out there. But Dharma practice unfolds when we look at our contribution to the suffering. And so it's a very adult thing to do, to turn into, what's my contribution to this? You're in a huge, heated argument with someone, and you're right and they're wrong. The Dharma thing to do, the analysis of Dharma, is using the Dharma investigation, is not to then investigate all the reasons why they're wrong. The Dharma thing to do, the path of freedom is found, not by justifying your stance. The path of freedom is found by turning your attention here and seeing, what am I doing to contribute to my suffering in this situation? You might still stay in the argument if it's necessary to do that, but maybe you don't suffer then. You're more relaxed. You're not clinging and, you know, self-righteous in the process of doing that. So Dhamma Vichaya has these different meanings. It has the meaning of just simply to look more carefully. What is this experience? Look more carefully and try to look and understand the nature of concepts, the interpretation. Look behind it and actually see what's happening more deeply. And that's applicable in all kinds of situations in life. Next time you're in an argument with someone, step back for a moment and try to look more carefully. What's really going on here? Rather than racing ahead with your beliefs. So investigation means to look more carefully. Investigation also means to look at the quality of your own mind. What's happening in your mind? Start becoming a sensitive to the range and changing qualities of your mind as they arise and pass. A lot of information about yourself is available if you notice the shifting qualities of your own mind-heart. And then the third meaning of Dhamma Vichaya has to do with using the basic Dharma principle of the Four Noble Truths as a way of understanding what's happening to you here and now, to take responsibility for your contribution to the suffering here. And in doing that, in doing these three things is how you could find the path of practice. So the Buddhist path is not found in a book, but is rather found in your application and investigation. Now, investigation in this way uses your intelligence. Investigation in the classic ancient text is a close partner to wisdom. It has kind of an analytical, can have an analytical quality to it. You're analyzing, you're looking, trying to understand. Some people don't like this because it agitates their mind. And they think that meditation is all about getting just calm and serene and empty in your mind. And now I'm supposed to think about things. So two things to say about that. One is that one of the functions of investigation is to bring energy into the meditation practice or into your life. Investigation is considered to be an energizing factor. And sometimes there can be a lot of sloth and torpor, a lot of tiredness in meditation, but there's not a lot of energy to do the practice. And one of the ways to bring more energy in is to investigate or to analyze or to look more, you know, these things. That's one thing. The other thing to say is that the goal of this practice is to become free of suffering. And the goal is to, in a sense, experience peace. Part of investigation, then, is to look, to notice how we might be investigating in a way that is making us more agitated. You notice that quality of agitation arising because of the way you're investigating. And then you do a course correction. Investigation has, you know, built into it, it's self-correcting system. So if you're doing it, you know, you're supposed to notice when you're doing it wrong. And then try to relax. Soften, relax, let go of something. And then see how soft or how relaxed you can be about your investigation, you're looking. Maybe stop investigating for a while. Because maybe you're trying too hard. But slowly over time, if you do mindfulness practice, you will naturally learn how to be more discerning, how to be more understanding of all these things, and how to differentiate between the ways in which you use your mind, the way you pick up things, get involved in things, so they cause more suffering, and the ways that you can let go of things, you can move towards greater peace and happiness. So, last example is, I use this almost. It's almost second nature for me to, in this, sometimes in meditation, to have this happen. Early in the sitting today, several times, my mind started drifting off into some kind of concern that I have in my day. And I could see, so I could notice that my mind drifting off in that concern. And I could see the tension connected to that being involved in that concern. And I had this very simple understanding that this is not, doesn't serve me right now. This is not what I'm interested in doing. So I could see it. I could see the tension that can arise. I could see the concern that could arise. And because it was relatively mild, I can just simply not continue with that train of thought. It wasn't even a matter of letting go of it. It's just not continuing. And then coming back and being here with my breath. So that involved a little bit of intelligence, a little bit of discerning, a little bit of investigation. It was almost second nature to do it. And with that ability, then the path of practice opens up and we go further. And one way of talking about going further is to talk about the factor of awakening called energy or effort, which is for next week. So I hope this was understandable and useful. What if it was, then you might spend the week exploring investigation in a variety of ways. Just look for ways in which you can bring, like you're salting a soup or something, why don't you try to bring some investigation into a variety of situations in your week where normally it wouldn't occur to you to investigate. You would just kind of bumble along, do what you normally do or something. So take, and try at least once during the week to look for some really juicy situation. Really juicy, like something that really would really, really kind of gets you, really would just irritate you or get your, you know, something going really powerfully. And you're ready to, you know, and something, really get caught. Do your very, very best. Choose a good one. And then choose your very, very best to not react. Just, you know, get a straight jacket, whatever it would take. Just not react. And, sit on your hands. I don't know what you would take. And instead of reacting, investigate. Look more carefully. And with the question, what's going on here? What's going on? Let me step back and let's notice for a while. Let's look and investigate and understand. So that's your homework, if you'd like. And so, thank you very much.